No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and we hope together that our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you, Michael. I just flew in this afternoon. I was in the San Francisco area. Well, actually in San Francisco itself for a conference with a great place to work, the company.
Yeah.
And they had CEOs of Comcast and Assurian and Quicken Loans and you name it. And these heavy hitters were there and talking about how and why their company was ranked number one or four in the world to be a great place to work. So it was beyond stimulating because it came from the bottom up for them.
Well, that's
to get
great.
These rankings. Yeah, it was really heartwarming to see what they're doing for their employees, including several companies have unlimited vacations. They say, I don't care where you do your job or how you do your job, just that you do your job.
Yeah, that's my daughter's company. It's exactly like that, unlimited vacations.
Unbelievable.
And it's great that you went to a stimulating conference because today is International Women's Day.
Yes, thank you
and
for bringing that up.
When we have our special guest on in a minute, we might talk a little bit among the three of us of why on International Women's Day we have no women candidates left in our race for president. But before we get to our very special guest, Terry Jaffe, let me just brag a little bit about my alma mater, the University of Maryland men's basketball team. I know you're a basketball fan. Is
yes,
number one in the Big Ten. They beat Michigan today to get that title. And right now, the Maryland women's team is playing for the number one spot against Ohio State, and they're up by 10 points last time I checked. So go Terrapins. I really feel great about that. And now, without any further delay, let's have Harry Jaffe on. We're so lucky to have Harry with us today. He's a journalist. He's an author. His stuff has been published in Playboy, Harper's, Esquire, the San Francisco Examiner, Philadelphia Inquirer, you name it. He's done it as a journalist and as an author. And he was brought to Washington as the press secretary to Patrick Leahy, senator from Vermont, great guy. And he's written a book. And one of the reasons we wanted him on the show tonight is he's written a book, I guess, after the last election, entitled Why Bernie Sanders Matters. And so without further ado, let's have him on the show. Harry, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's amazing how timely Bernie Sanders is for a guy who wrote the only unauthorized biography of Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont. He certainly writes a lot about himself, but he does hate when other people write about him. So a funny story about how I tried to interview the senator and how well that worked out, which was not very well. But anyway, it
sounds like you're being facetious.
I mean, one of the funny stories is that, you know, I have been a journalist in Washington, D.C., since the early 1980s, and when I first got the contract to write the biography of Bernie Sanders, it was the middle of 2015. And he was a junior senator from the tiny lily white state of Vermont, and he was a socialist, and he was a nobody in the U.S. Senate, and he declares for president, and all my friends said, why are you doing this book? Hillary Clinton is going to squash him like a bug. And we all know what happened after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know what? That was the thing. I mean, if we go back even further than that, because I by the way, I just was announced that I'll be a super delegate again. But I've been a super delegate for 4 or 5 conventions. And back when Obama ran, everybody made the same joke, didn't they, Harry? I mean, everybody said to me, it's like, who is this guy from Illinois? He's a junior senator. Hillary's got it wrapped up. He doesn't stand a shot. And, and you know, and Neil Axelrod just, you know, he realized that that people were supporting Hillary because they didn't have an alternative. So he came up with an alternative, and it worked. But, but yeah, you know, look at the well, tell us first why you think Bernie matters.
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders made himself matter because he, as we all know, he's a true believer in the working class and the travails of the working class. And he came upon this point of view, and he was coming up as a you know, as a Jewish kid in the Jewish part of Brooklyn in the 1960s. And then when he was a civil rights protester at the University of Chicago, he embraced these ideas and became ingrained in his belief system, his personal belief system, and then his political belief system. And so he kept saying it unadulterated and unaltered, and the world came around to understand how important and consequential those fundamental points of view and beliefs are, that the working class, the middle class, is getting the short end of the stick. And I think that why he matters is because he came upon the national political scene just as the income inequality in this country got to be gross and unacceptable and pronounced. And so that it's almost as if the world economically and politically came around back around to make Bernie matter more. I think that that's what I would say, and that he found receptive ears in among the young, the millennials, people like my daughters. I have 3 daughters. Each of them has you know, is working in their late 20s and early 30s. Each of them has a student debt. So it's not when he speaks to that group, they believe that he is the only one who represents their point of view. So that's why he matters.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, all my kids have student debt too. I've got 2 daughters and a son, and you know, it's so different. I mean, you're so right about that, Harry, because when I got out of college, I found my first job out of college in the newspaper. You know, I went to a want ad. I mean, it's the environment has changed so much. My kids laugh at me when I suggest they do things like that, you know, and I also put myself through college, but it cost me $1,000 of $750 semester.
I remember I went to a private college in Pennsylvania. I graduated in 1971, and I think that my tuition was $3,500.
Yeah.
Right?
And, yeah.
you know, you put a couple zeros on that, and now you're talking about what it costs these days, so, and double it. So it's, I think that Bernie matters because he, the things that he values and he talks about over and over again were, became much more damaging and hurtful to the people that he wants to appeal to. And he, you know, one of the questions that I asked in the book is, you know, how does a Jewish guy from Brooklyn who makes no effort to accommodate what people might want in their U.S. senator or their congressman, if you are in a rural state like Vermont, how does this guy get elected in the state of Vermont? And that, well, a large part of my book is about his political rise. I'll never forget the first time I laid eyes on Bernie Sanders. I was working for the Rutland Herald. It's a daily newspaper in Rutland, Vermont, working class factory town in the center part of the state. And I was covering politics, and I looked up on this on the TV screen, and there was a panel discussion, a forum for the U.S. Senate, and it was Bob Stafford, who was the incumbent Republican, and Stella Hackel was the Democratic challenger. And then this guy from the Liberty Union party, Bernie Sanders. And I got to tell you how startling it was to see Stafford, white hair, blue pinstripe suit, white shirt, red tie, Stella Hackel was perfectly turned out. And then Bernie leaning over the table with a Coke bottle glasses, sweat coming down his forehead, curly black hair, talking about imperialism. And that's how he got his start, but it worked in the state of Vermont, in particular because of the odd circumstances that where he won the mayor's race for Burlington in 1981, which was a peculiar in and of itself. So these are interesting political stories, but the thing that makes Bernie Sanders consequential and important now is that the working class that was getting screwed back in the turn of the last century and this century is still in dire straits. And capitalism has a weak spot about income inequality. We're seeing it. We're feeling it. And Bernie answers that question.
So was there a reason that he didn't cooperate with you on the book, Harry?
Yeah, he hates the press. He talks about the corporate media. One of the things that people have to understand is how similar Donald Trump is with Bernie Sanders. They both hate the press. Bernie calls it the corporate press, and he thinks it's controlled by, you know, Comcast and NBC and GE and Disney and he's right, but that doesn't mean that individual journalists are out to get Bernie Sanders. But I tried, when I got the contract to write this book, I went through all of the standard appeals. I went to his press person in the U.S. Senate and said, look, I need to, can I talk to the senator? Sure, I'll get back to you. Never happened. I went to his the guy who was running his campaign, and no, it's not going to happen. I followed the senator back to the Russell Senate Office Building after he gave a press conference for federal workers, and I caught him at the elevator, and I said, "Can I talk to you?" He said, "No." He got on the elevator, turned heel, and then I was biking. Because we all live in a pretty small town in Washington, D.C. I was biking downtown, and who should I see at the corner of Massachusetts Avenue and 6th Street? Bernie Sanders and Jane Sanders. And I said, Senator, it's me, Harry Jaffe. You know, when can we have a talk? And he looked at me, hailed a taxi, didn't say a word. I mean, he didn't even acknowledge my existence.
But you did speak with his wife, right?
Oh, I did speak to Jane. I did speak with Jane. You're exactly right.
How did that come to pass?
I sweet-talked the press person, and I said, come on. And, you know, if you read that section of the book, it's a sweet love story. I mean, it's how he and Jane got together is quite lovely. And I think that's a true, marriage of like-minded people who fell in love and are still very much connected and very much a strong political pair. So I did get to speak with Jane. Yes.
Well, I must say on a personal level, I don't know him very well, but as a superdelegate, he met with me and he asked me to consider him as a candidate, which was so different than the other people that met me with me who demanded my vote. You know, when I met with the Clinton people, they said, yeah, when are you going to get on board? You know, mm-hmm. and Bernie. So and he also did a personal favor for us on Capitol Hill, knowing my status is a tentative at best. And sometimes mm-hmm. the Democrats, extend certain courtesies to me. And the Republicans came after me one day and he sent his chief of staff to straighten it all out. And just a lovely man. And of course, he supports the statehood bill. So I think he's a lovely guy. But let me ask you this question. Where do these rabid people from the internet come from? Do you have any idea? Do we call them Bernie Bros? Who have just so savagely attacked people that don't agree with him. And it just seems so unusual to me. I have no sense of where those people come from.
Well, I, that's a product of social media, and that's a product of the anonymity that Twitter and social media affords people to be horribly mean and rotten. Yet be
trolls.
You know, not suffer the consequences and not look at people face to face. That happens. I think that's more a feature, not so much revealing about Bernie Sanders. I think it's more revealing about how we as a society and a country communicate now on social media. It becomes this consequence-free zone where people can just say and do horrible things and threaten horrible things. I don't think that is a reflection of Sanders and his group. I think that what's more informative and enlightening about Senator Sanders is, interestingly enough, and it is what Hillary Rodham Clinton said a few weeks ago about him, and everybody poo-pooed it because it's Hillary, and people discount what Hillary Clinton says now, sour grape, she's a loser. But she said that he didn't do very much on Capitol Hill, and he's not very well regarded in the House or the Senate. And my reporting in my biography bears out exactly what she said. That if you think about what a successful House member or a successful senator does, what are the components of being a successful senator, for instance? It's someone who knows how to gather a group together, co-signers, co-sponsors, and then have an idea, have a hearing, compromise, discuss, get in a back room, discuss what you want to do, make, change around the edges, go to the other side, cross the aisle, and come up with a piece of legislation that may not be perfect, but accomplishes maybe, I don't know, 60%, 80% of what the original sponsor was. Bernie Sanders couldn't pull that off. And the reason he couldn't pull it off is because he doesn't like people. He doesn't like to compromise. He doesn't like to compromise. And he's right. Bernie Sanders is right. That's where, Senator Brown, this is where I think there might be a connection between the Bernie bros and Senator Bernie Sanders, because he's right. You can't ask him any questions. It's his dogma. Medicare for all. Well, do you want to work towards that? And maybe we work from Obamacare and gradually get to Medicare for all? No, no, no. It's Medicare for all, take it or leave it. And that kind of an approach is good if you're leading a so-called revolution, but if you're trying to craft legislation where you compromise and discussion is so essential to that process, that's why Bernie Sanders, you know, has like three bills under his belt, three pieces of legislation under his belt for like, you know, 50 years in the House and Senate. So I'll give you another interesting story. I was when there was a brief moment when Senator Sanders had a leadership position in the U.S. Senate, and it was when the Democrats were in control of the Senate, and Sanders was chairman of the Veterans Committee. And put through a very important reform of Veterans Affairs, he worked very closely with Senator John McCain, who was at that point the ranking Republican on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Guess who, when I went to investigate that and talk about Senator Sanders' role, who got on the phone with me?
I don't know, McCain.
John McCain.
John McCain got right on the phone with me. I mean, and yet, I had to ask myself, I'm writing a book about Bernie Sanders. He won't talk to me. But John McCain will. And John McCain said very complimentary things about Senator Sanders, about how Sanders was a intransigent at the beginning, but that they wound up, compromising on things such as, contracting out the medical care for veterans. The Republicans wanted to, have it be a pay-as-you-go situation, and the Democrats wanted to keep it under the government control, and they hammered out a compromise. But I didn't hear about that from Bernie Sanders. I heard about it from John McCain. So,
And isn't that exactly what's going on now, Harry? I mean, what you're talking about. I mean, Biden's putting together this instant coalition, it seems, where he's not even really trying, right? You've got Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Bloomberg, Harris. They're all coming out and endorsing him, and people seem to be coalescing around him, whereas Bernie is still, like, out there, you know, right, as the Lone Ranger. Who's standing on Bernie's seat?
I mean, can you name one United States senator, one, that is backing the senator from Vermont? One.
Yeah. I mean, not even the woman that we all thought was kind of Bernie light. Now that she's dropped out of the race, maybe ultimately she'll support her. Yeah, of course, Senator Warren. But she's even going at it with trepidation. I mean, I think a lot of her supporters make over to him, but she's not willing to say yay
anything yet.
I was surprised. Maria, go ahead. Don't let me monopolize the conversation.
Thank you. Harry, since the adage is that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and this one in particular, how do you see him leading if he doesn't compromise?
Badly.
If he would be elected. Badly.
Badly. Badly.
Badly. And you know, everyone always says, you know, we got three branches of government, and so we're going to have checks and balances and stuff. But if he isn't willing to let go of some of his ideals, it seems to me he's going to get nothing done.
When people casually ask me, or ask me in a venue like radio or TV, what's my takeaway, having researched and written this biography, one of the things I have concluded is that I think he would make a lousy president. And I say that because the art of compromise and the art of leadership, I should say this, that leadership involves the art of compromise.
Right.
And Bernie doesn't get along with a lot of people. He's a gnarly guy. He is.
So he's like a curmudgeon.
I mean, well, with the, yeah.
I got to tell you, you know,
little patience
Senator,
and a
Senator
big
Brown,
temper.
Senator Brown, your takeaway from your conversation with Sanders about the superdelegates is one of the only times I've heard anybody say anything nice about a one-to-one conversation with the guy, because he's usually.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to say he's just usually has no time for you because he's got more important things to do, and whether it's scribbling on a yellow pad or talking to a crowd. I mean, the fact that he took time to talk to you that counts.
Well, you know, I've got to say I'm stunned. First of all, you know, when you talk about how did this guy, this Jewish guy from Brooklyn, become a senator of Vermont? I mean, also, how the hell did he become a socialist at the University of Chicago in the age of Milton Friedman? You know, how did that happen? It seems like he's an enigma all the way around. And the thing that really, really worries me as a Democrat, Harry, is that I remember being at the convention in Philadelphia, and for the first 2 days of the convention, all the Bernie people chanting, you know, Bernie, Bernie. And I wonder if Biden gets the nomination, are the Bernie people going to come over, regardless of what Bernie says? If he says, you know, let's all support the ticket, do you think that the kind of people that support him would do that?
I think some will, some won't. But here's the other thing about the Bernie people. There are some adages in politics, and some things that political pros going back decades will tell you. And that is that young people don't vote. And,
right.
And maybe in the age of the internet, maybe at a time when millennials are shouldering a lot of the debt, maybe that would change. I'm not so sure. So in answer to your question, I don't really know whether it matters all that much. I think that the people who are going to thumb their noses at the Democratic nominee because he's not Bernie Sanders, who knows how many there are going to be. But there's something else that I think is very, very important in the calculus of this particular race for the Democratic nomination for president, and that is, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat.
Right.
And I think that that's an important aspect of this, and he's a Democrat by convenience. He's essentially using the Democratic Party to run for president because there's no Democratic Socialist Party. He did the numbers and doesn't want to run as a third party. That's where he should be. He is a third party. You know, that would be a more honest way to do it. But because he's not interested in being honest. He's interested in being in the expediency of being the nominee. He said, okay, now I'm a Democrat. Hello, it's Tuesday morning. Yesterday, I was a Democratic Socialist. I was an independent. I caucused with you people, but I didn't really, I held my nose around Democrats, because he did. And if you go to back to Vermont and ask anybody whether as mayor of Burlington, as the sole House member for the state of Vermont, whether Bernie Sanders identified with the Democratic Party, no, never. There was a moment when the sitting governor, Madeline Cunin, the Democrat, and she was running for re-election. And I'm thinking it was like 1988 or something. It was a couple years ago. But Madeline Cunin, she was a good mayor. She was a good governor of the Green Mountain State, and she's in a tough re-election battle against a formidable Republican. And keep in mind, Vermont is not a Democratic state. Vermont is considered a Republican state in many ways. Anyway, Bernie Sanders is the mayor of Burlington, and he starts making noise about running for governor. And Madeline Cunin says, Bernie, please don't run for governor, because if you run for governor, you're going to take votes away from me, and we could have a Republican governor of Vermont. And what do you think Bernie did? He ran for governor. Because he doesn't play by those rules. He plays by his rules.
Well, he's just to underscore what you're saying, he's already filed for his reelection in 2024 in the Senate as an independent.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so yeah. He's not, so he's kind of simultaneously, and this is not unusual, as Harry. It's not unusual to re-up because then you can raise money for your campaign. But, he's kind of simultaneously a Democrat and an independent.
He's not simultaneously. He's using the Democratic Party.
Right. Yes.
He would never self-identify as a Democrat.
No, I know. And among the adages that you talk about, young people don't vote, is also the adage, never call yourself a socialist to the American public. I mean, I got to tell you, I was stunned by that. And I've got a master's degree in political science and have studied socialism. And it doesn't in the least bit scare me. But still, if I was his campaign manager, I would say, do you really want to go out and call yourself a Democratic Socialist? I think that's that scares a lot.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing about Sanders. And I think it's one of the reasons why he's successful is because he doesn't the difference between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Bernie Sanders is so stark because Hillary and her team, they would stick their finger in the wind every morning and right. figure out which way the wind was blowing, and then they would tailor their messaging around that. And people knew that and knew that it wasn't authentic. And Bernie Sanders has succeeded in his whole political life by saying, this is who I am, take it or leave it. Take it or leave it.
So he's consistent then. It's his brand, and it's never wavered.
No.
Yeah.
And the same is true of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is, the art of the deal. Right. I'm gonna lose millions of dollars. I'm going to go bankrupt. I'm going to leave the banks holding the bag, and I'm going to keep moving along. And I'm gonna say that the sky is blue, even though it's been raining for 2 weeks. I'm gonna say that the coronavirus is gonna disappear in April, even though it's just picking up steam. And you know, Donald Trump is not gonna change, and neither is Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
has the Biden camp been in touch with you, Harry?
No.
I would think that you have lots of valuable assets that you could share with them.
I would never share with them. I'm a journalist. They, you know,
yeah.
they can read my book. I'm pretty. I'm agnostic. I'm not for Joe Biden, and I'm not necessarily against Bernie Sanders. I'm just telling people what's behind the you know, the curtain as much as possible.
Well, and again, the thing you say about young people, the comment you made about young people, you know, there's been a lot of talk on Bernie's end about bringing new voters into the fold. But what we saw on Super Tuesday was that Joe Biden won 8 out of 10 of the states where voter participation had gone up. So especially in the states where it had gone up significantly, like Virginia,
right.
You know, so if anybody's bringing people into the fold, and I don't think they're young people, it's Biden and not Bernie. So, but
right.
Yeah,
right.
So
I mean, I think that if, you know, again, I think that there's a there are interesting commonalities between Senator Sanders and Donald Trump, in that each of them has a core constituency, but neither of them knows how to grow that. And if Sanders was more pragmatic and less dogmatic, if he was more of a pragmatist, he would have in the 4 years between 2016 and 2020, or you know, the 3 years between 16 and 19, he would have done some analysis, and he would have said, "Listen, you know, I can attract more mainstream Democratic voters if I just, you know, change my Medicare for All a little tiny bit, make it Medicare for All over, you know, in a gradual fashion, in a step-by-step process." If he had really tried to make inroads into the Latino community, which I think he did try to do. There's another thing about Sanders that I learned when I was doing my reporting for the book. And it came out during the 2016 campaign, is that if you go back and look at Senator Sanders' fundamental political positions, they really are economic, and they really are having to do with the working class. There's nothing wrong with that, but he had a blind eye and a lack of interest for social issues, racial issues. Why would Bernie Sanders have to be concerned with black people? Because in Vermont, guess what?
Right.
There are none.
I mean, why would he have to be at all sensitive to issues of Black Lives Matters? He also doesn't really care that much about LGBTQ issues, because it's not, he's a working class guy. He doesn't have the breadth of interest and understanding. And I'm not telling you that because it's something that I'm guessing about. That's my reporting from his, you know, what he did and what he cared about when he was in the House and then on the U.S. Senate. It didn't stir him. What stirs Bernie Sanders is working class versus wealthy people. And this country, the entire world came around to the horrible divisions between the haves and the have-nots. That's Bernie's issue. Bang. Zoom.
So that may explain then, Harry, I live in Los Angeles, and his campaign did a concerted effort to do outreach for Hispanics, including having bilingual staff members and going door to door in neighborhoods that have been previously ignored by any candidate, mm-hmm. let alone the Democrats. But mm-hmm. that might be because he saw them as working class, not as Hispanic.
I think that it was both ways. I mean, he's not stupid. His people are not stupid. Jeff Weaver's not stupid. They, you know, they are trying to tap into this kind of sleeping giant of the Latino, Latinx population. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, the comment you made, Harry, about Vermont being a white state, I've got to tell you, I was really, really annoyed at the beginning of this process. I went to Iowa, I was at the caucuses, and then when we came back and the press seemed to say that it was like, the, you know, all over for Joe Biden, because he had lost in New Hampshire and Iowa, you know,
right.
and how many, there were so few delegates involved,
right.
but also what white bread communities. And,
right.
You know, so how much do you think, I know that I've read things recently that there's people trying to hold the press responsible for Donald Trump's meteoric rise in the last election because they paid so much attention to them. Any idea as a top-notch journalist what we can do about this kind of 24-hour news cycle where they seem like they need to make stuff up if there's nothing there? You know what I mean? Because that's what it seemed they were doing to me. It seemed to me they were doing in Iowa and New Hampshire. They had to have something to talk about.
Right. I have no answer for you.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the nature of the beast, unfortunately, and you know, you've got to fill 24 hours of cable TV time, and I think you're exactly right. It's a lack of context, but I think that the struggle, journalists have been, you know, trying to hold a mirror up to their own reporting long before the cable channels and the internet were around to say why are we just writing about the horse race? Why do we focus on who's up and who's down? Well, there's an easy answer for that, and that is because it's news. We are news reporters. We do have to report what just happened. And if somebody wins or loses or comes in second or third or sixth in a campaign, you can count the votes and you have to, the news is who won. But where you're right, Senator Brown, is that there was a lack of context. And the journalists and the talking heads were too quick to say, well, you know, Biden's out.
Yep.
Biden's out. And
so
you're right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Bill Clinton lose both Iowa and New Hampshire and end up getting elected?
Yeah.
I think he did.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, we have precedents.
Right. No, I think that that you look, I hate to criticize my brothers and sisters in the news business, but you know, you guys are right. There's way, way too much emphasis on the breathlessness. It's really, I call it the breathlessness of reporting. Oh my God. Oh, look at
yeah.
the, oh my God.
yeah.
You know, just have a little bit of perspective on what what are we looking at here, and analyze it a little bit, and try not to be so incredibly breathless.
It's absolutely right, and investigative reporting is still so important. You know, I live in Spring Valley, Harry, so and I moved into Spring Valley. Spring Valley's a section of Washington, D.C., just about the time you were uncovering the fact that of these disposal pits and stuff in Washington. And thank God that you did that, because, you know, I remember I had to, as an ANC commissioner, I had to work with the Army Corps of Engineers on some trucking issues, and they were horrible. And I remember moving in and seeing these big UE helicopters coming in every day into Spring Valley, and having some military guy standing there saying, there's nothing to worry about.
I know, well,
you could see the guys in the hazmat suits. Right. You could see them in the background. You know, he's like, there's nothing here. You know, I mean, it was just amazing to me. So thank God that there are people out there like you that are working hard at finding the truth. Well, we're kind of running out of time here. Maria, do you have another question for Harry?
I do, Harry, because you caught my attention with saying something sweet about their love story. Can you give us a little bit about what the conversation with Jane was like in terms of that and their marriage?
Sure. When Sanders was running for mayor of Burlington in 1979, 1980, it was a long shot. He was taking on, you'll be interested in this, he was taking on the Democratic establishment. There was up in that part of Vermont, there was a kind of a Canadian, French-Canadian, Italian, you know, group, business people who were Democrats. And they ran the city. It was machine politics. And Sanders ran against that machine, and he did it beautifully, actually, by putting together a constituency of poor people, working class people, and believe it or not, cops, who were getting starved by the powers that be. But he was campaigning in door to door in Burlington, and he knocked on Jane's door. I don't know her maiden name, so but it was his future wife. He knocked on her door, and they kind of had a fleeting but that's how they first met. And then she happened to be working for a youth council that was involved with the city of Burlington. I don't think she was working for the city, but it was a youth council, and he wins the mayoralty, and they throw a party of some kind, and she shows up, and he asks her to dance.
Oh.
And that was the beginning of their romance.
Well,
wow!
It was on the dance floor, and they fell in love, and those are the two components that she talked about.
That's sweet. That's really sweet.
Yeah, it is sweet. He does have a heart somewhere buried in there.
He's been, you know, Harry, I worked in a Jewish family-owned clothing store growing up. That was my job. When I was 14, I got a job as a stock boy. And, Bernie, to me, seems like the classic curmudgeon, you know, that I knew people like that in the clothing business who were really gruff on the outside, but once you got to know them, they're a little better.
I'm not so sure Bernie is a little bit better. I'm just not convinced.
Well, let me ask you, you've done all these amazing things. What are you doing now? Tell us, what are you doing now? Because we're running out of time and we want to know a little bit about you. Are you working on
right.
any special projects?
Yeah, two in particular. I'm working on a memoir for an African-American businessman who has been president of Air Jordan for the past 20 years. And he's an African-American from West Philly. I happen to be also from West Philly. He's got an interesting story. It's not just, a black guy does well. He has some things in his past that are going to be revealed in the book. And I think it's going to be a it's going to be an important book in the prison reform movement. And then I'm starting a co-founded a nonprofit in Washington D.C. called Spotlight D.C., Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism, and we're going to raise funds to stimulate and put money in the hands of investigative reporters who will work on local matters, not national matters. But, you know, the District of Columbia has a budget, a government budget of $15.5 billion. Nobody knows that. And nobody knows where the money goes. Why do the schools not work? Why is the infant mortality rate so high? Why are murders, why is the murder rate creeping up? It's going unreported, and it's going unreported because the Washington Post has become a national and international newspaper. A lot of local news outlets, like everywhere around the country, have gone under. And so what really suffers is not just the daily local reporting, but especially investigative, you know, in-depth reporting, explanatory reporting. So Colby King and I, who's a columnist for the Washington Post, and Kojo Namdi, who is a radio star here for WAMU Radio, we have started a nonprofit to try and fill that hole.
Well, that's great. And if you have a website that, right, you know, where people can hook up, please give it to us. And let me tell you, I got in a fight with the Washington Post editorial board, and it didn't go very well because at one point I said, "You guys are not the New York Times. You're the Washington Post. Report on what's going on in Washington." They didn't take kindly to me telling
no.
me. They thought they were the New York Times.
You were right.
Yeah. We have a caller at the last minute on the show. You want to ask a question? Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm actually here, and I'm not calling with a question. I'm calling with a thank you.
Oh, no. Are you, you're here to thank Harry or to thank Maria?
Senator Brown, this is Tamara Harrison from Iowa. Tamara Harrison. Out here in Iowa.
Oh, my God. And Happy birthday, Tamara Harrison. Just had her birthday. She's an amazing person in Des Moines, Iowa, who her and her husband were such gracious hosts when we were out there. Well, thanks for calling in.
Well, it was so sweet of you to send a video that was presented at my party, and it was just so thoughtful for you to take the time, and so appreciate that. And I just had to call in, and I was listening to the show, so I'm going to call in and see if I can get in there just to say, you know, hi and thank you.
Nice. Well, thanks, Tamara. That's a lovely thing to do, and happy birthday. I
appreciate that.
I think it was 39 this year.
Yeah, sure. We'll go with that.
Exactly. Okay.
But before we go, Harry, what is your website, Harry, for your nonprofit?
Yeah, please tell us.
We're going to be live in a few weeks. It's going to be spotlightdc.org.
Nice.
So, right.
And how will you get your funding?
We're not there yet. We're right now appealing to local Washington, D.C. patrons, and then the next year we're going to go to foundations.
Perfect.
Right.
Good luck.
Well, thank you. Yes, good luck, because we really need
it. Thank you.
You know, it's you're so right about that. And thanks so much for sharing with us your expertise on all this, Harry. We so appreciate having you on the show. We hope you'll come back again sometime. Good luck with those three girls. I've got two girls myself, and you know, they really, and Maria. Maria's got more kids than I could count. How many children do you have, Maria? Four?
I have four children, three four sons children. And one daughter. So, yes.
Right.
And my boys are Bernie boys.
Interesting.
That's right. Yeah. My girls were Elizabeth Warren girls. So, but again, Harry, thank you so much. We always leave you with a song. This goes out to Harry Jappy and everybody, and you know, out there where there was no choice but to use this particular song. This is what, as much as it stunned me, Bernie Sanders is using as his campaign song, "Power to the People" by John Lennon.
Wow.
We'll see you next week. And thanks again, Harry Jaffe.
A pleasure to be on with you anytime.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Give the people their right to vote.